Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, James Holland. Al is busy finishing touches to his latest Sherman model, but I am joined today by Olivia Smith. Olivia, welcome. Thank you for coming on board.
No, thank you.
And you are, you're a young historian, aren't you, which is exciting.
I think that's rather a compliment. Thank you. Yeah, I'd say so. Aspiring young historian.
Aspiring young historian, but you have worked with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission.
Yes, I've done bits. I'd say I'm at the very beginning of my career right now.
The reason we've got you on is because you have a grandmother who is born and brought up in Nazi Germany, and you've talked to her at great length.
Yes.
So now she was brought up, am I right in saying, near Hamburg, is that correct?
Yes, Hamburg, near I believe it's called Lamberg.
Yes.
And she was born in 1935, so for her, she always says she was blissfully ignorant to be a child during Nazi Germany. Yeah. But lots of it she was very aware of. And both of her parents were in the hospitality business. Her father was in the civil service. And through that led them to become the steward and stewardess at the Hamburg Polo Club. This was like a really renowned...
That's amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. And, you know, it's full of...
Was the Hamburg Polo Club, was that quite exclusive?
Yeah, very exclusive. Lots of, she describes there being right. Lots of kind of like rich merchants, and especially, you know, there's a link here that kind of further on the story, lots of Jewish families. There is a cracking photo right. Of my great-grandfather stood at the Hamburg Polo Club right next to Kaiser Wilhelm II.
No way.
And it's fascinating, you can see him there. And so that kind of shows the, you know, the people that they were engaging with at the time. But at the outbreak of war, they kind of made a shift from, because of their career, obviously, it wasn't really the best paid job. And they made a shift from being stewardess and stewardess at the Polo Club to doing it at the Hamburg Barracks. So at the start of when the war broke out, my grandmother was at the barracks with all of these soldiers. They said they had a little apartment within the barracks, and because my great-grandmother was, I think she was in charge of the kitchen. Nanny said she could remember her making the soup and all the soldiers coming in. She could be in her little bed at night, and constantly on the stairs, you'd hear the soldiers' heavy boots hit the floor. But she said, and I kind of said, what was that atmosphere like? She said, it was very busy as war broke out, but she said everyone was so friendly. But I guess as a young child, wow, what would you really know? But she recalls the details she came out with was fascinating, because at the start of the interview she said, oh, I don't remember much, but she suddenly was able to say about this barracks, she remembers seeing this large, like, German eagle, gold. It fascinated her as a child, and this massive swastika underneath it at the kind of the gates. And they had this receptionist, or the reception, and there was the gold, red and black boxes there for, I think, for the mail for each of the soldiers. She was walking past these huge gun installations, as obviously it would have been a strategic place for Allied bombing if needed to be, right, and just being surrounded by constant military. At this point, obviously, her father was then called up to the war. He was taken into the infantry.
So how old would he have been at that time, roughly? Do you have any idea?
In his 30s, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, you know, and obviously German army in 1939, 1940 was very infantry heavy. So, you know, that was pretty much the natural first stop.
Yeah, and they believe that he was the first into Holland. And I have this fantastic photo of him on this bench in kind of, I think, just south of Amsterdam. And there he is in his, like, right, kind of Wehrmacht, I think, uniform. And it's a lovely little photo. And that's roughly around 1940. And they were still, obviously, at the barracks, right, at this time. And of Christmas 1940, they got the news that he'd been killed. And this has kind of been a bit of a controversy in a way of, we don't really know what happened to him. One story at the time, she said this German soldier come into the barracks kitchens and she was stood hiding behind the stove because he was so tall and she was scared of this guy. And he relayed the news just after Christmas that he had been killed, apparently cleaning his gun. And after talking to my mum about this the other day, she said that she recalls being told many years ago that after the Berlin Wall fell and she was reunited with family on the East Germany, that they told her they found out the truth that apparently he was shot due to his pre-war connections with Jews from the Hamburg Polo Club. And to this day, none of us really know what did happen.
Goodness me. I don't think he wouldn't have been shot just for knowing Jews in a polo club. I mean, I do think, you know, reported as killed for cleaning it, you know, while cleaning his gun does sound like a euphemism for being executed to me a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Seems like a bit of a cover-up.
But yeah, it's very strange. It's not unusual at all that you would have photographs. I mean, German troops were encouraged to take lots of photos in the battle, and they all did. And, you know, Germans were very into recording absolutely everything. They were absolutely encouraged. A lot of people had cameras and took photos. They were just avid photographers in Germany. And so you do see in this early stage of the war, you do see an awful lot of home movies. You see a lot of photos. You know, they're forever on. You can buy little collections on eBay and things like this that people have found in their attic and thought, well, I don't want anything to do with my German past, so I'm going to flog it. And so there's a lot of that goes on. But if he was attacking in the north, he'd have been in what was known as Army Group B. So the whole attack that was launched on the 10th of May 1940 was split into two. There was Army Group B, and the idea was that would come down in the traditional advance, which is over the Low Countries, which are obviously easy to traverse, and mountains and woods and all the rest of it, and river valleys. So they go over the top there. They draw up the British and French troops up through Belgium. All the while, Army Group A would then come round the back through the Ardennes Forest, which was believed, certainly by the French, to be impenetrable to kind of armoured columns. They'd come in round the back and capture them in this massive encirclement called a Kettelschlacht, which is very much kind of the traditional way in which the Germans approach battle. It's just on a much, much bigger scale. And you've got Luftwaffe, the air forces to support them and all the rest of it. So he would have been one of the infantry divisions moving in as part of Army Group B. And he'd have just been moving in on his own 2 feet. I mean, most of these divisions weren't mechanised at this stage. So they would have been dependent on horse and cart for transport. And for the most part, there would have been a few trucks, but for the most part, and they'd have been marching. So he'd have tramped all the way in. So it's fascinating that he's part of this kind of incredible moment in history, really.
It's odd in a way, because history just stopped so soon for him at the beginning of the war. And, you know, it's 1940 and then suddenly we've got another, oddly, you know, 5 years to carry on for it. And, you know, for my grandmother, that war was still going on for her.
So what happened to her? What happened to your great grandmother? I mean, what happened to your great grandfather's widow?
Yeah, she carried on working at the barracks whilst Hamburg was even being bombed. But during that time, her children were evacuated. So she was quite. They did whilst they were evacuated.
So they were completely separated. Completely separated.
Yeah. So my grandmother's sister, who was about 6 years older, she went up to Denmark. Her school was actually taken up to Denmark, and I believe my grandmother described it, they apparently placed schools there as part of Hitler's plan to the Aryan race and encourage it further. She was placed there, and she recalls, you know, having stones pelted at her, flour, everything. She was scared being there. Whilst then my grandmother and her brother were taken over to Prussia. So it was very different on where they were taken to.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because here in the UK, you know, we think of evacuation. We just think of Britain's experience of evacuation at the start of the war and briefly in 1938, the Munich crisis. And, you know, and lines of children on Waterloo Station with little kind of luggage labels around their necks and all the rest of it. You forget that the whole of Europe is doing this. You know, kids are being evacuated from Turin and Milan in northern Italy. You know, kids are being evacuated from Hamburg and all the major cities in Germany as well, of which, of course, your grandmother was one. It's incredible, really.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting because it really highlights this history. It kind of opens up the narrative. And I think it really shows that this truly was a global war, and in every single sense. But for her, they spent, I think, about a year there. And then as during this time, so her brother was in the Hitler Youth. And her sister was then in the female version, the BDM.
The BDM?
Yes, the BDM. And she's always said it was a lot stricter.
The League of German Girls.
And she said that was a lot stricter compared to what her brother was in with the Hitler Youth, which I find very interesting, an element of strictness compared to, you know, in differing agendas.
Similar sort of thing, though. They did a similar sort of thing to the Hitler Youth, which obviously is for the boys. But in the BDM, you know, they would have lots of political indoctrination, of course, lots of camping, outdoor activities, lots of acrobatics and exercise and sports and all the rest of it, but also sort of home stuff as well. So it's a kind of, you know, it's obviously less martial, but it's still about being outdoor and robust and healthy and exercise and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the same principles.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting what you said about, like, indoctrinating, because that was a word throughout the whole interview that she kept referring to. They were indoctrinated.
Right.
And I think that's something that obviously was really resonant with her, of what her siblings, and she must have witnessed what they were going through. But during this time, so this was just, that was her brother and sister, and also during this time her cousin was a kind of little blonde cripple. His last name called Horst, and he has a really interesting story, as I think especially we look at popular narratives of the Second World War and you think concentration camps and you think what the Nazis did to people, you would naturally assume with the Jews. But he was a typical German Aryan boy. In 1943 he got taken to the doctors and was diagnosed as a cripple. And the doctor, apparently their duty to report to the Ministry of Health, the Nazi one, and say, this boy's a cripple. And he got taken away for treatment. He was taken to southern Bavaria. They never saw him.
Jesus, I thought they'd be slightly worried whether they ever saw him again.
They didn't, unfortunately. They begged, you know.
No.
They begged.
They never saw him again?
They never saw him again. They offered, they sent them chocolate. They said they got even travel permits.
Holy moly.
They found out, so years, I think actually only within the last 20 years, they found out, because my grandmother's German name is Halbenreiser. And in Germany, that's an extremely unusual name. And they did a search, and there's only two people in the entirety of Germany they found with addresses of that name. And one of them was in Hamburg. And it's a direct descendant of him. So it was one of my grandmother's kind of lost relatives. And they found out, and what this person, one of his relatives, had discovered, that in Bavaria, he was taken to a special institution. And basically, the Nazis systematically starved him. And he died. They found a certificate of death on the 16th of May, 1945.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
God, I'm absolutely gobsmacked by that. So this is, but this is sort of effectively part of the Action T4, you know, which is the euthanasia program.
Mm,
You know, you're some way imperfect, you just get rid of them, and then you get rid of the bad gene pool and, you know, everyone turns into the Aryan super race. I mean, God, it's bonkers, isn't it? That's so awful. God, I'm absolutely stunned by that. I really didn't expect you to say that. Well, I mean, God, I mean, how do you feel about this?
It's very emotional, I have to admit, because, you know, it's one of my relatives. For years, I've always I've never been ashamed to be German or have heritage in that way. But when I heard that, it made, took away any stigma, because I thought my family was involved in it as well. They were as effective in that side as well. They weren't Jews. She describes him as a young blonde boy, blue eyes, the most typical things that you would expect of an Aryan race.
Yeah, but he's a victim of the Holocaust as well. I mean, you know, that's, you know, wow. I mean, you know, this is all Karl Brandt and these sort of wacko physicians and stuff. I mean, it's wow, that's unbelievable. And have you got any pictures of him?
I believe so. She's got a full, what the family, I know that they found in Hamburg, did a full research on it. and she's got it all, but it's all in German. So she's been trying to translate it for me so I can have it all in future. So I can happily send some on to you.
Yeah, yeah.
After a year of being over in Prussia, you know, they didn't know if they were ever going to see their mother again. And one day out of the blue, her brother come running into her room and was like, "Lisa, Lisa, Mutti's here." And he said she was so confused. He went, "I've seen her ring in the bathroom." And we still can't understand how they recognised she'd turned up in the middle of the night and she'd come to collect her kids and she took them back over to Lemberg. And she collected her children and she said, you know, my nanny said she kind of remembers that journey on the trains. It was very stressful. Mm-hmm. Lots of soldiers, lots of Red Cross nurses as well. And they obviously couldn't go back to Hamburg where they originally were, as it was completely bombed out, and that's where they then settled in Lemberg. Yeah, it's such a you think for such a young child, the distraught, the emotional trauma, probably not even realising it you'd be going through.
So and when was she picked up? Was this sort of Operation Gomorrah, which was the destruction of Hamburg, end of July, beginning of August 1943?
I would say right.
So
then.
It's that kind of time when your mother's back.
Yeah, I would definitely say around that time. Yeah, she never really gave us any dates.
So then what happens to her in the last 2 years of the war? So, I mean, you know, the noose is tightening around Germany. I mean, it's not as though... I mean, obviously there wasn't much left to bomb in Hamburg, but there was still plenty of bombing nearby. I mean, you know, Bremen and Bremerhaven and Wilhelmshaven, they're not a million miles away from there.
Or, you know, members of the Nazi Party would always wear badges, and she was always told by her mother to be careful of informers. And she didn't want to be seen to say anything out of place. There's recollections of hearing...
Well, that's what it did. That's what it did for a lot of people like your great-uncle. I mean, you know, it was informers. Mm. You know, the Action T4 programme was completely dependent on informers.
No, exactly.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the series World on Fire. Yes. There were lots of things that I kind of really didn't like about it, but the informing on the charts, you know, that's exactly what was going on.
Yeah, exactly. And she said that you were always so weary of people around you and what was going on. There's an element of like paranoia, I think, just from having a day-to-day life. And there was other little things by her sister would go simply just get flavourings, because obviously they didn't have any food. She describes like maize. I think they lived off maize soup for years.
Well, rationing in Germany was spectacularly worse than it ever was in the UK. I mean... You know, I grew up as a boy in the 70s, kind of, you know, with constant people saying, you know, that's far too much butter on your toast. You know, in the war, .. You know, rationing in Britain was pretty tame, even post-war when it got a little bit worse. You know, compared to Germany, I mean, you know, Germans were starving. I mean, one of the main reasons they went into the Soviet Union in the first place, apart from the kind of a whole ideological strand, was because they were so short of resources, and particularly food and fuel. I mean, that was one of the prime reasons for doing it. And... You know, Germans really suffered in the war from the point of view of hunger. I mean, you know, particularly if you're urbanised, you know, you don't have the kind of, you don't have the bounty of the country and you're dependent on it coming in. And the more the country's getting bombed, so the infrastructure's getting damaged and it's harder to move stuff around. And they simply don't have the wherewithal to produce it anyway. So I'm not surprised she remembers sort of, you know, crappy maize soup.
Yeah, exactly.
So where was she at the end of the war then?
Where at the end of the war, she was still in Lemberg, so they spent quite a lot of time there.
Yep.
The end of her war story, I think, is just absolutely fascinating. They said there was whisperings amongst all the elders of a big Allied parachute landing has just happened. And I believe that's on the Rhine with Monty and the guy, you know, crossing the Rhine there.
Operation Varsity. Yeah,
so I think that it was interesting, you know, the whisperings, you could imagine kind of what's going on amongst society thinking. And she said they knew when they heard this that it was soon going to be over. And she describes this constant rumbling. You could hear people, you could hear the kind of rumbling of the Allies getting closer and closer and closer. Amazing. And the tent shows, you know, you could see how Lemberg is, how do I describe this, is structured. So it's like on a cliff. So you've got a lower part of the town and then the upper part of the town. And she was on the upper part of the town. And obviously strategic Allied bombing or shelling, anything was come to the top. So on the top, right near her house, was all these gun emplacements, machine guns, artillery of the Germans. And she said they used to run along and play in front of all these guns. And she used to see the long chains, I think, of like the machine guns. And you'd see them all kind of whispering down into the cliffs. And they were red. She said that you could sense there was kind of rumbling. Everything was going on as they were preparing, obviously, for the Allies coming. They blew the bridge. The Nazis did. There was obviously a big bridge because they were right on the Elbe. So they blew the bridge And as they did that, everyone, the sirens started going off. So they knew they had to go into their cellars. And she said everyone, she describes how lucky they were, everyone had cellars. I think it's how typically the houses were designed there. And then suddenly the sirens were going off. She said you could hear the Allies on the other side of the water. And so they all went down into cellars, pots and pans on the head. They took their bedding down and they were there for about 5 days, I believe. 4 to 5 days. She said it really started to kick off and around the 24th of April. So this is only really kind of 75 years ago, last week, roughly. She said as they were down in the cellars, they were in the mattresses, and she said you could hear the shells coming up into the top. And she described it as, you know, when you jump on a bed and the mattress kind of bounces and it kind of like the shockwave. Mm. She said that's what it constantly felt like. You were vibrating and you could feel it around you. And then on one night, their house got hit. And it was only a tiny little house. So when they came back from, when her mother brought them back from Prussia, somehow she managed to get a house built for them all. Small little house. Yeah, how on earth she did that? Yeah. I find that fascinating in wartime Germany. And this shell took off, I think, half the side of the house. And she describes this glowing shrapnel coming through the centre into the cellar. And luckily, she says, how lucky it didn't catch a light.
Yeah, goodness.
And there they were.
That's very vivid, isn't it? It's very vivid. It's obviously very kind of imprinted on her mind, her memory.
I think this final bit, the kind of like the liberation in a way, was really the key moment for her memory. She would have been 45, nearly coming up to 10. So I think as a child, it would stick with your memory quite a lot now. Mm-hmm. But as this is going on, as the house is destroyed, obviously part of it, the doors off, everything as well, she said the silence then crept in. It was the eeriest silence, she said, you could ever imagine, because suddenly you've gone from bombing to absolutely nothing. And then suddenly her mum was to say, keep quiet, everyone, keep quiet. There's footsteps. And they could hear these footsteps getting closer and closer and closer. And suddenly these soldiers come in. They didn't know if they were British, they were Germans, who they were. It turns out they were British soldiers. And they shone a light on each of them to see, apparently she found out after there was lots of sniping going on. The fanatics were going until the end, she describes. And her mother pulls her sister back and says, you must stop, take your badge off, because she still had a Hitler Youth badge on. So that's a sign of the Nazi party. And her sister, who would have been 6 years older, so into her kind of late teens, she wanted to fight. She wanted to go and carry on. She wanted to go pick up a gun. She wanted to go for it. And her mother really had to be like, no, you sit down, you take your badge off, and we are, this is it. And she said it was a very tense situation. And even afterwards, her sister went and got water and took it to the prisoners of German prisoners in the kind of the big camps that the Allies set up and gave them water. And the same, I believe, with her mother did as well. But I think it was more, I don't know if it was sympathy. She kind of said they were indoctrinated, but she always described that afterwards, they all knew what was best and, you know, they understood the implications of the Nazis themselves.
Sure.
So it was just really interesting. She said then the Allies in her little house at the end of their garden, they set up the administrative base there. So they had the British there. And the British soldiers, after they'd originally first come down to cellar, they all left them and they then returned. And they brought them, as she always describes, I think, now this was the story that's always stuck with me, that her first piece of chocolate and fruit for the entire war was delivered by the Allies there at the moment.
Well, good for you for doing it. And I hope you'll get her permission and to kind of send it on somewhere where it can be, you know, the Imperial War Museum or National Army Museum or any of these places. They'd all absolutely die for that oral history. Really would. And, you know, good for you for doing it, because, of course, so many of us kind of, oh, if only I'd spoken to my grandfather, great uncle, whatever, when I had the chance. You know, many people don't. It's really important to get these memories down while you can, so good for you. And that's an amazing story. I'm absolutely gobsmacked about the brother.
Yeah.
Terrible story, isn't it?
It really is. And I think it's even worse that it took so long for them to find out. They just assumed that he'd... Yeah. They had... No one had any word of it at the time. No one had no clue. They said that his parents were writing to the officials to be like, please, can we come see him? We've got these travel passes. He loved chocolate, apparently, and they sent these officials chocolate. And it's just all those kind of little heartbreaking stories. And I think what's really important is the fact that, you know, this did happen to German people as well. What he looks like, your typical Aryan figure. And you think, why?
Yeah, sure.
And yet it still happened.
Absolutely terrible. Well, Olivia, thank you so much for sharing that. It's been brilliant having you on.
No, thank you.
That's just been absolutely fascinating. And clearly your grandmother's an amazing woman. And those the bouncing mattress analogy. I love that. It was incredibly vivid. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you for having me on.